My theme tonight is Fireproof Faith. And our reading is found in the third chapter of the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 3, reading from verse 49 in chapter 2, actually. Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 4. The herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and language, that when you hear the sound of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship the image shall be cast into the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no heed to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound of music to fall down and worship the image which I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. The expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. He ordered certain mighty men of his army to bind them and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their mantles, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were cast into the burning fiery furnace, because the king's order was strict, and the furnace very hot. The flame of the fire slew those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these 3 men fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste, and he said to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered, "True, O king." He answered, "But I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come forth and come here. Then they came out from the fire. And the satraps and prefects and governors and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their mantles were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and set at naught the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. What a lovely children's story. It's on a par with any of the fairy tales, isn't it? But it seems very remote, doesn't it? What relation has that to us today? Many people don't doubt the veracity of the record, but they do doubt its relevance. But I wonder. Mr. Alan Crane was one of our missionaries who worked in southwest China with Isabel Kuhn's husband and with J.O. Fraser behind the Rangers. And there they saw a great movement of the Spirit of God when tens of thousands of the Lisu people came to Christ. After the communists took power, about 40,000 of these Lisu Christians moved out of China into Burma, where they were given asylum. And there's a very fine Lisu church going in Burma today. But Mr. Crane, after our missionaries were compelled to leave China, he knew the language and he was very burdened for these people. And he was able to go into Burma and visit these friends, many of whom he had worked with, and some of them being students in his Bible school. And he was very moved as he met some of his old students. And he asked for about one young man named Titus, who was a very promising young fellow, and asked where he was. And they told him that when the communists came, they were persecuting the Christians, and they took this young man and tried to get him to recant and deny his faith. And he refused to do so. And they said, well, if you won't recant and deny your faith, we'll roast you over the fire. And so they took him, and when he wouldn't recant, they held him over the fire for a while until he was burned, and then they took him off and then gave him another chance to recant. And then when he wouldn't, they put him on again. And this was repeated until the chariot of fire took him up into heaven, charred in body but undaunted in spirit. So this story isn't so very out of date after all. This was told to me by the man who heard it from the people who had seen what had taken place. And there are still burning fiery furnaces. And I don't know if you realize it, but this century has seen more martyrs for Christ than any century in Christian history, far more than in the history of the early church. And so this story isn't so irrelevant as it might seem. And who knows what coming days are going to hold for different peoples of the world. The whole situation is so unstable everywhere that anything can happen overnight. And so perhaps this passage has something to say to us, even in our circumstances. Nebuchadnezzar had been impressed with the caliber of these four young men, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were remarkable men, obviously. And to the chagrin of all these satraps and counselors and officers, they were promoted above them. And nobody likes having foreigners get positions that belong to their own people. And you can imagine how popular those four young men were. They really were very much out of favor. And they determined to get rid of these three interlopers. And the fact that Nebuchadnezzar set up this image that everybody was to worship gave them the occasion they were looking for. The three men were in no doubt as to what they should do. They knew God, and they knew the law of Israel. They remember that the law had said, "Thou shalt have no God before me. Thou shalt not make any graven image." So their course was clear. They would not bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's image. And Nebuchadnezzar was in a furious rage when this was told him. It said in one place he was in a furious rage. In another, he was full of fury. But what happened? Nebuchadnezzar said, "If you won't bow to my image, you'll burn in my furnace." And these young men were faced with a tremendous situation. I'd like to bring before you, first of all, the three resources of faith which these young men had. First of all, you'll find it in verse 16. They had faith in the ability of God to deliver them. "Our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us." Every one of us would subscribe to that. We believe that God is able to do everything in general. He is omnipotent, therefore there's nothing he can't do. And we have no problem in assenting to that. But often it's a different matter, because it takes a special exercise of faith to believe that God is willing to do it in our special situation. When we have before us an alternative such as the burning fiery furnace was to these young men, it's all right to subscribe to the general fact, but when it comes to the particular instance, and you have before you the alternative of being thrown into a burning fiery furnace, and there is the king with all power, it's another thing to believe in the ability of God in this particular case. And these young men gave great glory to God. Could anything have seemed more impossible than that they should be delivered in that situation? "Is my God able to deliver me from my threatening furnace? Is he able to deliver me in my impossible situation?" Thank you. It was an impossible situation. And God sometimes shuts us up to impossible situations in order that we might be cast upon him. Have we got this first resource of faith? My God is able to deliver me even in this impossible situation which I'm facing now. There is nothing too hard for God is a good general principle. But is it applicable in this situation? Am I prepared to trust him here with an alternative like that? Am I prepared to step out in faith upon this fact and say like they did, "Our God is able to deliver us"? They had a second resource of faith. They believed and had confidence in the willingness of God to deliver them. Our God is able to deliver us, and He will deliver us. Impossible though it seemed, they didn't see any way through it. I'm sure they never dreamed what was going to happen. They could see no possible alternative, and yet that didn't hinder them from having an absolutely undaunted faith in God. They never wavered for a moment. But many of us who concede the ability of God are not quite so sure about His willingness when it comes to certain situations. You remember, the leper came to the Lord and he said, "Lord, if you're willing to heal me, you can." And what did the Lord say? He said, "Turn it round the other way. You've got it wrong way around. I will. I'm willing, all right. I will. Be thou clean." We have a God who is willing to deliver us. There is no situation in which, if God sees it is in our highest interests and for His greatest glory, that He is not willing to deliver us. And we can have perfect confidence in Him. It seemed as though, at first, as though God was indifferent to their plight. He didn't do anything about it. He just left them there. There they were standing while the furnace was being heated seven times hotter. He didn't deliver them in the way they expected, if they did have any expectation. But they had this second resource. Our God is able to deliver us, and He will deliver us. Most of us can get that far. But have we got the third resource of faith? "But if not." Those are three wonderful words. "But if not." The third resource was acceptance of the sovereignty of God. These young men recognized that God was sovereign. They accepted that fact, and they recognized that it might not be the purpose of God in this case to deliver them from the burning fiery furnace. But their faith had this resource: "If not, we still will not bow down and worship, O King." What a wonderful attitude this was. And if we can master this third resource of faith, we are growing in spiritual maturity. One of the great problems in connection with the healing movement lies just here: a reluctance to accept the sovereignty of God in the matter of healing. The Bible teaches the sovereignty of God very clearly. I know that there's a hard and harsh way of presenting the doctrine of the sovereignty of God that is, I believe, contrary to the spirit of Scripture. But the Bible teaches that God is sovereign. The parable of the potter, the Lord said, "Cannot I do with you, O Israel, as this potter?" It sounds rather harsh, doesn't it? God can do anything He likes with us. We're just like a piece of clay in His hand. But alongside that parable in Jeremiah 18, we need to put Isaiah 64 and 8. And that verse says, "But now, O Lord, Thou art our Father. We are the clay, and Thou our potter." So that in the one verse, God has brought together two great important truths. The sovereignty of God — He is the potter, and He has absolute power over the clay. And the other, the paternity of God. He has a father's heart. And because of that, it assures me that anything God does in His sovereignty will never clash with His paternity. Everything he does is dictated by a father's heart of love. I don't know whether these young men knew that truth, but at any rate, they had great confidence in God. Our God is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us, but even if he does not, our faith will not be stumbled. I think that's a wonderful attitude. Why sometimes does God in his sovereignty not do what we expect him to do or what we want him to do? The reason usually is because he's got some better thing. He didn't do what these young men expected, but he did something immeasurably better, didn't he? You think of Monica, for example, the mother of St. Augustine. He was a profligate in his youth. Broke his mother's heart, and she used to pray and pray that God would save her son. And he still continued in his wayward way. And then he told his mother that he was going to go to Rome, and Rome was a sink of iniquity. And when Monica heard that, she pled with God, "Oh God, don't let my son go to Rome." And God did let him go to Rome. He didn't answer her prayer. But it was in Rome that he found Christ. He had a better thing than answering her prayer. She couldn't understand why God didn't answer her prayer, but he had some better thing. And for these young men, although they didn't know it, while God seemed indifferent and didn't intervene, it was because he had some better thing. They believed in God's ability, but they also recognized that God, in his sovereignty, may not will to exercise his ability on their behalf. And if so, they accepted the will of God without reserve. Their attitude, I believe, is something that we should emulate. We know our God so well, or we ought to, that we're not stumbled by anything that he does because we know him as our Father. In the event, it looked as though there was reason for them to be dismayed. It seemed as though they had been overlooked, as though God hadn't responded to their faith. You'd have thought that he would have responded to their faith and loyalty by taking them right out, and perhaps bringing judgment on the others, but he didn't do that at all. He was silent. Wasn't it Coleridge who said, "The worst of God is that he does nothing about it"? And sometimes that's true. He seems to do nothing about it, but he's always there at the right time. But they were not stumbled because they had the third resource of faith. Have you incorporated those three words into your spiritual vocabulary? But if not? If God doesn't do what you want him to do, is your faith going to be stumbled? If he brings you into an impossible situation, and then he seems to leave you there and doesn't deliver you, is your faith going to be stumbled? Or will you say, "But if not, I'll still go on trusting you. My faith has not come to an end"? The next thing I'd like to draw your attention to is the three implications of faith. And the first is this, that faith is always confronted with a choice. We can always take either the high road or the low road. There's always the opportunity, and often the decision whether to take the high road or the low road is an agonizing one. These young men had to face the alternative: worship the image or be incinerated in the furnace. And if you can imagine a more difficult situation than that, I'd like to know what it is. What a tremendous test it was for these young men. The early church had to make their choice. Will you just offer a pinch of incense to the emperor?
You don't have to deny your faith, but just offer a pinch of incense to the emperor. The Japanese Christians during World War II, you didn't have to stop practicing Christianity, but you just go to the shrine and bow. That's all. It seems so small a thing to do. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you don't have to deny your God, but just bow to the image that the king has set up. Faith is always confronted with a choice. If there's no choice involved, there's no faith needed. When God called Abraham, he had to make a choice. Was he going to stay in the comfort and luxury of Ur? Or was he going to take a step of faith and go out not knowing whither he went? He had to make a choice. Moses had to make a choice. And so in every case, if you go through Hebrews 11, you'll find that there is a choice always involved in faith. And then the second thing. Faith always involves a risk. If there's no risk involved, faith is not necessary. If we can see the way ahead, what purpose does faith serve? We can walk by sight. We don't need faith. Abraham couldn't see where he was going. It must have been a tremendous test to Sarah. You know, of course, that Ur of the Chaldees, where they lived, was a very highly cultured place. One of the very interesting things they discovered was that in Ur of the Chaldees, they even had flush toilets. Imagine that. But it was a society that was on a very high level. And here, suddenly, God says to Sarah that you're to leave all your beautiful home with its modern conveniences, refrigerators and washing machines, and you're to go out and live in a tent, and you won't even know where you're going. What an attractive program. What a risk on God. How are they going to know? How is God going to reveal himself where they were going to? But here Abraham, the father of the faithful, stepped out in faith. And did God let him down? Now in your life, in the Navigators, in my life, in missionary work, we're constantly called upon to face situations like that. And we will be. God doesn't ask us whether it's convenient. He doesn't take business considerations into account when he's sending us out. Sometimes he doesn't even seem to take family situations into account. And it takes faith sometimes to step out when he's calling us to do things. I remember when I had to face up to leaving my legal work and going into the Bible college work. My father had a very serious breakdown, and my mother wasn't able to handle him very well, and for about a year I had to look after him, and then there came what seemed to me to be the call of God. But I thought, how can I leave my father? I've got my family responsibilities. I'd given up my legal partnership because of his illness. And I'd gone back to business again, but now after I'd been there for some time, there comes this challenge to go out into God's work. And I was very puzzled to know what to do. Where did my primary loyalty lie, to God or to my father? Did he not want me to fulfill my family obligations? Well, I'd done it in the first case, and I'd made a sacrifice to do it, and now, what do I do now? Well, as I waited on God and prayed, there came a growing and strengthening conviction that God wanted me to take a step of faith. And even though it was very timidly, I took that step of faith, and it was very interesting. I had taken that position only a week or two when my mother wrote me. She said, "I've taken your father down into the country to my sister's place, and ever since we left Dunedin, there has been no return of his trouble, and there never was again." It was a very difficult decision, but yet God had called me to do it. And when I did it and took that step, he honored it, and he looked after my father, my mother. Now, I know many of you will have that kind of situation, and sometimes it would be wrong to go and leave them. But if God gives clear, unmistakable leading for you to do it, you can trust him with the results. He'll look after it for you. Faith always involves a risk. There was the risk that my father would be damaged by the fact that I wasn't there. But God is faithful, and when we step out in faith and in obedience, we can trust him to the very limit. Not everybody enjoys taking risks. Some of us are we may be bold enough in physical things, but very timid in taking risks of faith. And yet, I believe that progress in the Christian life will always involve taking risks on God. Do we know God so well? Our God is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us. But if not, we'll still go on trusting. I married twice. My second wife was a friend from ours from our early years. And on one occasion, my wife and I took her to some meetings that were being held by Dr. Graham Scroggie. This would be way back about 1934 or so, something like that. And Dr. Graham Scroggie was preaching on Jericho, the capture of Jericho. Now, the day before this, I'd gone to see in hospital Jack Miller, who was the fiancé of Mary, my second wife. And he was in hospital. He'd had 100 operations for osteomyelitis, days before penicillin. That disease, bone disease, would just break out in another place and have to be treated again. And he was in hospital for another operation. He was a student in the Bible College then. So I went to see him, and I said, "How are you, Jack?" He said, "I'm terrible." He said, "I wish a 10-ton truck would go over me. The pain's so terrible." Well, on the morning when we were listening to Dr. Graham Scroggie, he spoke about the fact that the Israelites had to walk around Jericho 13 times. And he said, even after they had walked around Jericho 13 times and had been completely obedient to God, nothing happened until they shouted the shout of faith. And when they shouted the shout of faith, the walls fell down flat. It was a very fine message. But as the three of us were walking away from the meeting, Mary turned to us and she said, "I was able to shout the shout of faith for Jack this morning." Well, I must confess I had my reservations. 100 operations and waiting number 101? Well, next day Mary went to the hospital to see Jack. And he was very bright. And he said to her, "I had a wonderful experience yesterday morning." She said, "What was it?" He said, I was reading my Bible, and I was reading in the 6th chapter of Joshua about the conquest of Jericho. And he said, I never noticed before, but it wasn't until the Israelites shouted the shout of faith that the walls fell down flat. And he said, I shouted the shout of faith. How wonderful. Here were we on one side of the harbor, and Mary shouts the shout of faith. And here's Jack on the other side of the harbor in the hospital, and he shouts the shout of faith. And what happened? He never had the operation. The disease never returned. He was 27 years a Baptist minister and died of a coronary. What a risk. What a risk on God. And yet, how wonderfully God answered. But I'd like you to notice something. What Mary said was, I was enabled to shout the shout of faith. You know, sometimes we march round our Jerichos. We go round and round and round. And we never get to the point of shouting the shout of faith. And that's why the walls don't go down flat. There is the fact that we have to do the circuits, and maybe we haven't completed the 13th circuit. But I believe that when we do complete the 13th circuit, the Lord will give us the assurance and enable us to shout the shout of faith. And if you've got some Jericho you've been encircling for a long time, ask the Lord, Lord, has the time come for me to shout the shout of faith? And when you shout the shout of faith, the walls fall down flat. I like the story of Robert Moffat, the father-in-law of David Livingstone. His church wrote to him and asked him what he would like for Christmas. They wrote about June. What would he like as a present for Christmas? Now he wrote back and he said, I'd like you to send a communion service. Now, Moffat had been working in Bechuana land for 7 years and had not seen one convert. Well, what's the point of a communion service when you've got no communicants? What was he doing? He shouted his shout of faith. He'd walked round the walls of his Jericho. And now the time has come. What do you want most? What would you like us to give? There's one thing he wanted, a communion service. And when the communion service arrived at Christmas, do you think there were any communicants? God couldn't refuse a faith like that. And of course there were. And they sat down together and observed the Lord's Supper. A third thing. Faith will always encounter opposition. You can be absolutely certain that when you take a new step of faith, you will be opposed. In our mission, when we plan new forward moves or anything like that, we always ask the question, what is the counterattack going to be? Because if you were the devil, what would you do? Do you ever ask that question? If I were the devil, what would I do? I think it's a good question. What would I do in this situation if I were the devil? How would I counter it? Faith always meets opposition. Well, we ought to be alert to find out what it is. And opposition won't just fade away. Satan will resist in every power at his command any forward movement for God. Last year I was traveling in Canada with one of our young missionaries, a young fellow about 37. I've seldom met a fellow with such a passion for souls and for the Lord. He worked in Thailand and God had blessed him wonderfully. And I consider this young man is one of the most promising men and very needed in our needy field in Thailand, which is so terribly difficult. And I could see a great future for him. He went back to Thailand. He'd only been there a few months, and one day he said, through a meeting he was addressing. He said, you know, what we need in Thailand is people who are prepared to die for Christ, not only to work for him. A week later, he was preaching the gospel in a home, and a man came in the door and shot him in the face and killed him. The man, I would say, would probably be the most indispensable man in church planting in that field. There it was. Opposition. We've been praying for a breakthrough in Thailand. And here comes the adversary, a counterattack. He picks off the one that is probably a key man. God's not defeated, but here is what we can expect. If we are in warfare, we can expect casualties. And in the field of Thailand, we've lost 6 or 7 by martyrdom and nearly 20 in other ways. No other field but in Thailand. It's been here, there's been special prayer launched on that land that is so in the power of darkness, but there's been real casualties. And we can expect opposition. How else can faith grow unless it's tested? And God gives us the opportunity of testing. Then let us think of the deliverance of faith. Deliverance from trial is not always our highest good. God didn't deliver them from the fiery furnace. He delivered them in the fiery furnace. I believe that the escapism that is attached to a lot of teaching on the second advent is entirely contrary to the spirit of the New Testament. The great desideratum is not that we should escape the tribulation. The Lord said, in the world you shall have tribulation. I don't think that should be our great desire. I'm not anxious for tribulation. But Paul says, I glory in tribulation. Well, that's quite a different spirit. I glory in it. I can't say I've got that far, but never mind. I don't like the other spirit. Here in the scriptures, God does not always deliver his children from trial. He doesn't say, I'll give you immunity. You ask the Christians in China what they think about tribulation. You ask the Christians in Cambodia what they think about tribulation. I believe that we need to be prepared, if that's God's plan for us, to go through with tribulation. I don't come down any side on pre or post tribulation. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the coronation of Christ. That's the triumph and glory of Christ is the blessed hope, not the rapture of the church. I believe in the rapture of the church. I believe it could come tonight. But that's not the hope of the believer. The hope of the believer is the coronation and glory and triumph of Christ. He shall reign over all the earth. He who wore the crown of thorn, whom men deemed of little worth, whom they met with hate and scorn. I believe that that is the thing that should be galvanizing us into action. God does not always deliver from trial, but he does deliver in trial. He did this. He did this for them. The incidence of trial in Scripture is very unequal, isn't it? And uneven. He doesn't treat everybody alike. And that causes some people to be offended. Do you remember when Jesus said to Peter, told him by what death he should glorify God? You'd have thought that Peter would have been rather occupied with that, but that wasn't what concerned Peter. He saw John going by and he said, well, what about this man? Is he going to get preferential treatment? Is he going to die like I am? And what did Jesus say to him? Peter, what is that to you? Follow me. Even though somehow it seems as though God is unequal in the way in which he deals with us, he really is not unequal. There is a day when everything is going to be straightened out. You remember Peter and James, for example, they both went out to preach the same gospel. They were both put into jail. But God allowed James to be executed. And when Peter was in jail, he sent a special angel to go and strike the shackles off his wrists, open the prison door, and took him to a prayer meeting. No, that doesn't sound equal, does it? And yet, I'm quite sure that James and Peter now have no problem about it at all. They know that God was doing the right thing. Have you ever thought that Peter got 3,000 souls and Stephen got 3,000 stones? It doesn't seem equal. God delivers some from trouble. He delivers some in trouble, in the midst of it. Is our faith fireproof? Have we got a but if not in our spiritual vocabulary? Have we got that third resource? If war comes, but if not. If business fails. If old age enfeebles. If disease overtakes us. If unemployment strikes. If bereavement comes. If a life partner is not granted. If our plans are thwarted, if our service seems unrewarded, if we have to work with uncongenial people, have we got that third resource? But if not, my faith is still firm. I am not stumbled by what God has done. We need to emulate the faith of those dauntless three. They didn't fall into self-pity, but they trusted God. The Lord said something that I found of recent years very helpful. He said, "What I am doing now, you do not know, but you will understand afterwards." One of the advantages of growing old is that you're in the afterwards, and you can look back. And you can see things which at the time were quite inexplicable. And you say, "Ah, now I see why." And he told us to expect that. Amy Wilson Carmichael, that great missionary, said, "I cannot remember one case in which the Lord has explained to me why he did certain things." God's under no obligation to explain himself. But notice as I close the compensations of faith. Why, what compensations came to those young men? Our faith is not unappreciated by the Lord, nor is it unrewarded. You think of the first thing that happened. They had companionship with the Son of God. What a wonderful experience. You know, it's in the furnace that God draws nearer. He didn't draw near until they were right in the midst of the flames. But he did draw near then. And sometimes God allows us to go right into the furnace before he draws near. These young men had risked everything on God. And God responded in a way that was worthy of himself. Notice the control of the flames. They burned with a strange discrimination. The only things that they burnt were the bonds that bound them. And Nebuchadnezzar couldn't believe his eyes. He looked. He said, "Were not three men cast bound into the furnace, but I see four walking loose." How wonderful. God controlled the burning of the flames. I find that very comforting. If we're walking in the furnace of affliction, it's all right. He's at the bellows. He knows how to control the burning of the flame. And we can trust him. They walked in a new liberty. They walked with Christ in utter freedom and fellowship, walking with the Son of God, something which they would never have enjoyed had God delivered them from the burning fiery furnace. Have you ever wondered why it mentions the details that the fire didn't have power over their body, their hair, their coats? They were thrown in with their tunics and their hats and everything. Why put in silly little details like that? Oh, there was a reason for it. Isbar was the Babylonian god of fire. And this god must be decisively defeated. Supposing the fire had power over them, the people would have been able to say, oh, well, it's true that Isbar wasn't able to destroy them, but he left his mark on them. They won't need a haircut for a while. The whole moral effect of the protest of these young men would have been lost. But it says that the fire didn't affect their bodies, their hair, their clothes. There wasn't even the smell of fire on them. Here is something absolutely supernatural. Here God was demonstrating the superiority of the God of Israel over the gods of Babylon. Job had a but if not in his vocabulary. He said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I'll go on trusting, even though he slays me. He goes to the limit. The Lord Jesus had a but if not in his vocabulary. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, but if not, thy will be done. Have we incorporated that into our vocabulary? Can you imagine those three young men after the experience sitting around having morning coffee? And they're saying, how glad we are that God didn't spare us the experience of the fiery furnace. What we would have missed. How impoverished our lives would have been if we hadn't had that fiery furnace experience. There's always some image claiming our worship. There's always some worldly thing that will say, bow down and worship. And if we don't refuse to bow down and worship the God of popular custom, then we pay the penalty. Have we got the words of those young men who said those wonderful words, our God is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us, but if not, be it known that we will not serve your gods or worship your king. And the upshot of it was that King Nebuchadnezzar made that tremendous statement concerning God. There is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. And he had the spiritual insight to see the reason behind it. And you see that in verse 28. He delivered his servants who trusted him. We cannot trust God too much. We can trust him to the very limit, because he is the faithful God.